He did not explain what we were doing in Libya. He took sides within a civil war itself.
The congressional delegation reacts to the U.S. role in Libya. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, the 29th of March. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, the federal government works to clean up an old mine site on the Kuskokwim River.
The metals most commonly occur in this ore deposit are arsenic and antimony and mercury.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. To protect our environment, dispose of medication safely at an authorized community medication disposal event or follow these steps. 1. Place medications in a sealable plastic bag with coffee grounds or kitty litter. 2. Add water to dissolve the medications. 3. Seal the bag and place in the trash. The Alaska Safe Medication Alliance and the Drug Enforcement Administration are hosting medication disposal events statewide on April the 30th. Visit www.akila.org/rx. This message is sponsored by South Central Foundation.
Alaska's congressional delegation has concerns over the U.S. mission in Libya and questions about the end goal. Last night, President Obama addressed the nation about his decision 10 days ago to take military action in the North African country. The U.S. and NATO are enforcing a no-fly zone over Libyan skies. While the president said NATO is expected to take over more of the operation this week, the U.S. is expending its planes, missiles, and hundreds of millions of dollars. It's a Republican member of the delegation, Senator Lisa Murkowski, who has the warmest words for Obama's speech.
I felt that the president did a fair job of laying out the case as to why we went in, just kind of detailing the real atrocities that Gaddafi is inflicting upon his people. And I think the president, again, reminded us that when our interests and our values intersect, that there is an appropriate role.
Murkowski says the U.S. and other leading nations can't stand by and watch the slaughter of innocent civilians. But she has grave concerns about what happens next and wants to make sure the U.S. isn't mired in Libya for a long time. Just what happens next is also of concern to Senator Mark Begich, and he says the U.S. cannot be the world's peacekeepers and police force.
At a certain point, if this is the new policy, we can probably name a dozen countries that have dictators that are as bad or worse for their citizens. Are we going to do every country now? We don't have the money and we don't have the personnel, and we've lost a lot of lives already in Afghanistan and Iraq.
The Democrat says he has strong reservations about the U.S. action. The Obama administration will make its case before Senate and House committees later this week, and Begich expects to ask questions at an Armed Services Committee hearing. Congressman Don Young says he has no love of Colonel Muammar Gaddafi and thinks the Libyan leader should have been, in his words, eliminated a long time ago. But he does not think the U.S. can afford this effort.
Now, why France and England were so excited about this? Probably because they depend on that oil. And I just think he didn't explain it to the people. He didn't consult with the Congress. He didn't do any of the things I think he should have done.
Young still stands behind his vote supporting the Iraq War and says Saddam Hussein was a leader that needed to be removed. He says, however, that the U.S. should not be in Afghanistan and says it's unwinnable. Congress is not really focusing on it yet, but behind the scenes, a number of federal agencies are beginning to grapple with the practicalities of dealing with climate change, particularly in the Arctic, where the average temperature has risen much faster than in the rest of the country. In much of Alaska, an average degree and a half above 1980s temperatures last year. A new report for the U.S. Navy is an example. APRN's Steve Heimel tells us more.
It's usually the Coast Guard that is thought of when it comes to shrinking sea ice, but it's the Navy that regularly sends nuclear-powered submarines under the ice. Earlier this month, the USS Connecticut popped up through 26-inch thick ice to rendezvous with the USS New Hampshire, which set up a research camp on the ice. The subs came from opposite directions, the New Hampshire through the Northwest Passage, the Connecticut up through the Bering Strait. According to a report by the National Research Council, climate warming should give the Navy plenty to be concerned about. It points to a lack of surface presence in the Arctic by the Navy and the lack of any infrastructure to support that presence. It urges the Navy to support the Coast Guard in pressing Congress to order the construction of new icebreakers. Both of the Coast Guard's heavy icebreakers are under repair, and only the lighter Healy is left in the fleet, and it is largely used for scientific missions. Senator Mark Begich could end up a key player in this effort. He's now chairman of the Commerce Subcommittee on Oceans. The icebreaker situation and his new chairmanship were touched on in a speech this month to the state legislature.
Alaska is ground zero for climate change. Your constituents are seeing it and feeling it every single day. Alaska is well positioned to influence the new challenges and opportunities in the changing Arctic.
Beyond the icebreakers, the National Research Council report has five more recommendations for the Navy, including more submarine presence, beefed up sea ice forecasting for navigation, more international partnerships, and ratification of the Law of the Sea Treaty, which is how any country establishes jurisdiction over the Arctic Ocean. And it calls on the Navy to do an assessment of coastal vulnerabilities in light of rising sea levels. It says not only is the ocean now rising at the very maximum rate forecast by the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, but storm intensity is rising as well.
One storm surge can do a whole lot more damage than a slow sea level change.
That's Gary Mitchum, the former director of the University of Hawaii Sea Level Center. He is probably the nation's top authority on how fast the ocean is rising. He was not a part of the NRC study, but he concurs with it.
I agree with that completely. I do believe that the largest impacts that we're going to see on human beings from possible climate change is not so much the direct sea level rise signal, but it's due to the change in weather.
Mitchum looks forward to improvements in computer modeling that he says will forecast storm surges with enough certainty to allow experts to write detailed response plans. They need probabilities in order to do that, and the modelers are only a few years away from being able to give it to them. It was not so long ago, he says, that we didn't even have the ability to say where sea level was, but now we do, thanks to accurate satellite altimeter readings that can be compared with tide gauge readings. That's the good news. The bad news is that those more accurate readings are telling us that the ocean is rising faster than we thought. The NRC report forecasts a rise of close to 3 feet by 2100. That's the way Mitchum sees it as well.
My own estimate is very, very close to that. I usually tell people something on the order of 1 meter by 2100 is the best we can do right now in terms of best guess.
That's enough of an ocean rise to affect about 9% of the land in 180 coastal cities in the United States, according to a new study from the University of Arizona. The NRC says the Navy should be prepared for more humanitarian assistance and disaster relief missions, and it needs to look at the vulnerability of its own bases around the country. Perhaps the most troubling aspect of the new science on sea level is where the high water is coming from. When the last IPCC report was written in 2007, it was assumed that the ocean was rising about 2 millimeters a year, and it was mostly due to expansion because it was warming. More accurate measurements show that it is rising about 3 millimeters a year, and a good half of that is due to the fact that glaciers are melting.
Now the 3 millimeters per year that we're talking about now, a much larger fraction of that appears to be coming from the ice sheets as opposed to the thermal expansion.
The glacial melt is confirmed by gravity measurements by satellite. It's coming from the Greenland and Antarctic ice caps. Whether you are the U.S. Navy or a regional emergency services planner, it's time to start including adaptation into coastal planning. In Anchorage, I'm Steve Heimel.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, public employee unions are the target of a new bill in the state legislature.
Everybody likes to say that public employees have a Cadillac plan and are living high on the hog. Not the case.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Full Circle. Full Circle grows, picks, and delivers fresh, certified organic produce year-round. More information about their 400-acre farm and their organic partners at fullcircle.com. And by BP, supporting public broadcasting in Alaska.
Threats to public employee collective bargaining rights have reached Alaska. Palmer Republican State Representative Carl Gatto has introduced a bill mimicking controversial measures in Wisconsin and other states. Gatto says he wants to ensure fiscal certainty for future generations of Alaskans. But Governor Sean Parnell and Gatto's fellow lawmakers say it's unnecessary. KTOO's Casey Kelly reports.
House Bill 200 would do away with public employees' collective bargaining for health care, retirement benefits, and working conditions, but keep it intact for wages. Bill's sponsor, Representative Carl Gatto, says it's a preemptive strike against the financial uncertainty currently being experienced in other states.
Our children are already saddled with enormous debt on the federal level, $47,000 for every man, woman, and child. And all these states are now having debt. Well, they can't borrow money for their debts. They're stuck.
Alaska has more than $10 billion in reserve funds, but oil tax revenue won't produce at the same level forever. But why go after public employees? Gatto thinks the public sector has had it too good for too long.
I think we've gotten some gold-plated medical benefits, some gold-plated retirement benefits that nobody in the private sector has. They think this is pretty spectacular.
Everybody likes to say that public employees have a Cadillac plan and are living high on the hog. Not the case.
Jim Duncan is business manager for the Alaska State Employees Association, the state's largest public employee union representing about 8,500 workers. He's also a former administration commissioner and has negotiated contracts on both sides of the table. Duncan says Gatto is misinformed when it comes to the state's labor negotiations. State workers bargain for wages, working conditions, and an employer contribution to health care, but that's it. Retirement is non-negotiable.
It's real overreach by Representative Gatto. He's trying to address a problem that doesn't even exist in this state, and I'm very confident that that bill will not pass this legislature.
He says working conditions for state employees could potentially suffer the most if the bill were to become law.
We have good measures in the state, but there are times when problems occur at the work site, and we need to be able to assure our members and assure the working men and women of this state who are public employees that if they're having difficulty at the work site, they do have some protection, and that comes through their collective bargaining agreement that we've been able to negotiate with the state.
Duncan says ASEA is ready to activate its membership to protest the bill if it's scheduled for a hearing, but that appears unlikely with less than 3 weeks left in this year's session. House Democrats call the bill foolish, and Governor Sean Parnell says he thinks collective bargaining is working just fine in Alaska.
Negotiations are being conducted in good faith, both by our administration and by the unions, and I've seen no reason to change the current structure at this point.
Gatto's bill does have its supporters. Bill Starr represents the Eagle River Chugiak area on the Anchorage Assembly and serves as chair of its Budget and Finance Committee. He's been critical of union contracts negotiated by the administration of former mayor and current U.S. Senator Mark Begich. A private developer, Starr says his employees don't get anywhere near the benefits received by city workers.
We'd like to keep and retain our employees, obviously, but the attitude that we would give something that's not offered in the private sector, that's just not necessary.
Gatto's bill would exempt police, firefighters, and other public sector workers who are unable to strike from restrictions on collective bargaining. A former member of the Anchorage Firefighters Union, Gatto admits he's heard from some former coworkers who are opposed to his legislation.
I'm not sure what they think because I haven't talked to them in 20 years, but they feel, why am I doing this? Well, read the bill and think about what the future holds.
Gatto has introduced a broader right-to-work bill, which would prohibit collective bargaining agreements that require employees to join a union. That bill, like HB 200, has no co-sponsors and has yet to receive a hearing. A 2009 state survey showed Alaska provides more money to individual health plans than most other states, but less than the overall market, including the private sector. And in 2006, the legislature voted to change the state's public employees' retirement system from a defined benefit plan, which guarantees a monthly pension for retirees, to a defined contribution plan similar to a 401k account. In Juneau, I'm Casey Kelly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. The State of Alaska Department of Revenue reminds you to file online now for your 2011 PFD. Paper applications are available at the same 270 statewide locations as last year. More information at pfd.alaska.gov. This message sponsored by the State of Alaska. No other port in Alaska is building a 100 rail car loop like the one going in at Fort McKenzie. Exporting natural resources from rail to ship will be more efficient than ever. A single limestone deposit in the interior could mean a cement industry in Alaska. Fort McKenzie Rail, hundreds of millions in state revenues, thousands of jobs. This message sponsored by the Matanuska Susitna Borough.
Alaskan lawmakers are again considering legislation that would require health insurance companies to cover the diagnosis and treatment for autism. As it is, parents of autistic children say they have to pay thousands of dollars out of pocket to cover therapy and counseling costs. KFSK's Matt Lichtenstein reports.
State Senator Johnny Ellis says he's talked to a lot of families with autistic children from his community of Anchorage and across the state.
There's just a real plea out there to be able to help these kids get up to speed as much as possible to avoid future costs to families and to school districts and to help these children live full and rewarding lives.
Ellis is sponsoring Senate Bill 74, which would require that health insurers in Alaska cover the costs of the diagnosis and treatment of autism spectrum disorder. That spectrum includes a range of mild to severe symptoms. It can affect a child's ability to speak, understand, and interact with others, as well as their movement and their perception of sensory input like sound and touch. Ellis says the bill itself is pretty simple.
It requires coverage for evidence-based, medically necessary, something that's called applied behavior analysis, that's the term of art, that have shown by studies to be the effective treatment for this disorder. You know, like kids with any other disease, there should be coverage for this affliction.
Ellis's bill has a companion in the House with identical language. HB 79 is sponsored by Anchorage Representative Pete Peterson. Peterson proposed a similar bill in 2009 after a mother came to his office and spoke at great length about her family's struggle to find help for her autistic son.
And all the financial troubles that had been created to the point where they had to spend down their other children's education funds, take out second mortgages on their home, and were still finding it difficult to provide the needed treatments that their son was using.
During the last legislative session last year, Peterson's original measure was held up without a vote after one hearing before the Health, Education, and Social Services Committee of the House. The new version has yet to have a hearing in that committee. A call to HESC committee chair Wes Keller was not returned in time for this report. Alaska's largest insurance provider, Primera, is opposed to the legislation specifically because of its requirement that insurers cover applied behavioral analysis. That's according to company spokesperson Eric Erling. He says Primera does cover some costs associated with autism, but as a general rule, Erling says the company has concern with legislative mandates that tend to drive up costs.
Our health benefits do right now cover physical therapy and speech therapy. Our main piece of concern with this legislation is that it's mandating the coverage of an additional form of treatment that has where the research is contradictory and doesn't consistently show that it's beneficial for the treatment of autism. And so in that sort of scenario, our concern would be about the impact on costs for our members.
But for families with autistic children, the costs are substantial. Petersburg's Kari Peterson, no relation to the legislator in the story, has insurance through her employer, but she still has to pay thousands of dollars and even write grants each year to cover the costs of therapy and counseling for her son, who has autism. She thinks the legislation is needed.
There's a lot of services that my child needs that he just doesn't get because we can't afford them. And we're left wondering all the time if he would be as far behind as he is, if he had access to better quality care.
While she supports the legislation, Peterson would prefer the United States provide universal health care for everyone. In the absence of that, she fears this could just be a Band-Aid. A number of other states have passed similar legislation. Senate Bill 74 was scheduled for a hearing this week before the Senate's Health and Social Services Committee. In Petersburg, I'm Matt Lichtenstein.
The city of Fairbanks is holding public comment sessions tonight and tomorrow night on a city commission task force report about fluoride in drinking water. The task force spent the last year researching the issue and recently released a draft report that recommends Golden Heart Utilities stop adding fluoride to municipal water. Many communities across the country have stopped adding fluoride to the water over concerns about health side effects, including dental fluorosis, a pitting or mottling of tooth enamel that baby teeth are especially susceptible to. There are also less proven links between fluoride and skeletal fluorosis, endocrine gland disruptions, and cancer. Fairbanks Fluoride Task Force member Dr. Beth Medford says a recent American Dental Association recommendation that fluoridated water not be used to reconstitute baby formula was key for her.
For me as a pediatrician, you know, anything that's in the water that the ADA is not 100% certain is completely safe for infants, just shouldn't be in the water.
Water with one part per million fluoride has been linked to dental fluorosis. The fluoride concentration in Fairbanks city water was recently dropped from one part per million to 0.7 parts per million in response to the new ADA stance. Many dentists stand behind water fluoridation as an important tool for preventing cavities. Dr. Medford says task force members struggle to weigh the pluses and minuses of fluoride in water.
There definitely was not a consensus, and that's kind of a point that the task force as a whole wanted to make fairly clear, was that we were not in agreement. It's not a cut-and-dried, black-and-white issue. Even amongst this group of people who studied it ad nauseum, we still couldn't completely decide. And I think certainly there were members of the group who felt leave fluoride the way it is, some who felt that just lowering the fluoride, and some who felt that we should remove the fluoride. So it's a really complex issue.
Medford says there's a lot of data on fluoride in water, but none of it is definitive. The issue is complicated by the inability to account for variables like how much fluoridated water people drink and other factors affecting dental and general health. The U.S. Bureau of Land Management is getting ready to peel back a layer of the contaminated Red Devil Mine on the Kuskokwim River. The old mine site already holds the regrettable distinction of being the largest producer of mercury in the entire state. This next summer, biologists will try to see how much deeper the pollution runs. KYUK's Shane Iverson has more.
While families on the Kuskokwim might be looking forward to catching some big kings this summer, Matt Barner will be trying to catch some big bugs.
We love to see the big ones. We're really happy when we're out there working and we get a net full of big guys.
Barner will be collecting bugs in the Red Devil Creek, which runs into the Kuskokwim River. He needs about 500 to 600 of these bugs to add up to a 1 gram sample. And he needs dozens of samples to gauge the health of the water near the old mine site.
Bugs are there. They stay there until they mature to an adult, and then they fly and lay eggs, and the whole cycle starts over again. So they're really good indicators of water quality and watershed health.
Barner and other biologists will be busy trying to pinpoint sources of mercury contamination in the land and water around the old Red Devil Mine. The mine is located right on the Kuskokwim River in the Kuskokwim Mountains. It first opened in the late 1930s as a mercury mine and ran for several decades, discarding the leftover minerals near the river, says Mike McCrum.
They always process the ore on site and then just dump the tailings next to the processing facility.
Those tailings are not held in any sort of containment area, so the metals in those tailings are found in the surrounding environment. McCrum, who works on the project for the Bureau of Land Management, says those minerals are similar to ones found in the depths of the Kuskokwim Mountain Range.
The metals most commonly occur in this ore deposit are arsenic and antimony and mercury.
All can have seriously detrimental health impacts on humans and other species in the environment. The Red Devil Mine is a BLM Superfund site, meaning that no responsible party could be found to remedy the problems there, so the federal government stepped in. They say the key to a successful cleanup will be pinpointing exactly where the metals are coming from and how they are moving around. The surface layer mercury has been found on top of the tailings. This summer, biologists will dig dozens of holes to measure contamination in the subsurface. They'll also study a delta where mine developers dumped leftovers from a sluice operation right into the Kuskokwim River in the early 1970s. Preliminary studies show an elevated level of mercury in the waters nearby. The entire cleanup project involves several federal agencies. They've been hosting meetings in communities along the Kuskokwim in hopes of learning more about the site from locals. Last week, they met in Bethel. Jim Fitcher is a field manager for the Bureau of Land Management out of Anchorage. He told the audience that similar meetings had resulted in a new understanding of the mine for his team.
For example, last year one of the residents of Red Devil took Larry to a powder house location that we had never been able to, that we'd never located or mapped out. And so we were able to clean up that site because of that local knowledge.
The cleanup effort is many years old, but over the next few years, project leaders will develop a comprehensive plan for a final cleanup and years of monitoring. McCrum says that plan will be hashed out over the next 3 years, but now is the time to bring everything to the table.
And if you think that we're missing something that we ought to be looking at, we'd like to hear about that as well.
The BLM held another meeting in Queefluk last week. They will hold future meetings in Red Devil and even Anchorage later this spring. For KYUK, I'm Shane Iverson.
Alaska isn't exactly known as a mecca for gardeners, but a bill establishing a public gardens day passed the State House this morning. House Bill 18 was sponsored by Democratic Minority Leader Beth Kurtula of Juneau, who says a constituent proposed it to her and she initially dismissed the idea.
I think that gardens are wonderful, but I wasn't sure we should have a state day. And if I learned anything, it's this: you don't take on master gardeners. They are a very tough group.
Under the bill, the Saturday before Memorial Day each year would be Alaska Public Gardens Day. Kurtula sees it as an opportunity for Alaskans to explore the types of gardens they can grow and for tourists to learn more about small-scale agriculture in the state.
It is unbelievable how many people travel to places simply to see the gardens. I know that from going to Victoria to the beautiful gardens there, but similarly, people are incredulous at what we can actually raise in Alaska, you know, given that we're, of course, ice-bound year-round and live in igloos.
The bill passed the House 37-1. Anchorage Representative Mike Hawker cast the only no vote. It now goes to the state Senate. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at APRN.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Casey Kelly in Juneau, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, and Shane Iverson in Bethel. APRN's Libby Casey reported from Washington, D.C., and Steve Heimel from Anchorage. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Kristen Spack. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by the Center for Distance Education at UAF, offering online courses from any location. Information at distance.uaf.edu/learn. And by the Association of Alaska School Boards. AASB believes in investing in early childhood development. It can produce great dividends for kids and our state. More information at aasb.org. To protect our environment, dispose of medication safely at an authorized community medication disposal event or follow these steps. 1. Place medications in a sealable plastic bag with coffee grounds or kitty litter. 2. Add water to dissolve the medications. 3. Seal the bag and place in the trash. The Alaska Safe Medication Alliance and the Drug Enforcement Administration are hosting medication disposal events statewide on April the 30th. Visit www.akila.org/rx. This message is sponsored by South Central Foundation.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.